Folks, thank you very much. My name's Tom Ivester, and I'm an alcoholic. Just told Jenny this reminded me of the Democratic National Convention trying to get this mob assembled here somewhere or other. Hate to break up such a fun time. I'm a member of the Big Book Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Southern Pines, North Carolina. And my... my sobriety date is February 2nd, 1957. And we sort of have a custom of doing that back our way. I know that everybody here is intimately acquainted with where Aberdeen, North Carolina is. But just in case there's anybody that might not, if we called a town meeting and every citizen in our town showed up, it would be about two-thirds of this crowd. That's my town. Now, if you don't think you take an old country boy from a small town in North Carolina like that and put him in a place like this and swinging, laid back, rolled out, just plumb rich, Northern California. Good Lord. Now, this is high cotton, folks. I don't mind telling you, this is high cotton. I am delighted to be here. I sit now, I'll always be grateful to Jalila. I'll never quit appreciating that girl. I'm sitting there, everybody from the preacher to the Chamber of Commerce, man, drunks too. I was listening to them. Everybody just is articulate, just the diction and the flow of words. And I thought, good God, now here they got me behind all that. And then here comes Jalila. An AA grape? Are you talking about a Freudian slip? God, girl, I love you forever. That made me feel right at home. It has just been great being here. I got over jet lag last night. I got in and had a chance to see Dave and May, my good buddies from Reno and formerly from Southern Pines, North Carolina. They met me at the airport. And I had my first visit, I think, to San Francisco. And that is truly... you know what I mean. I really do believe the first one. I don't remember anything about that place at all, so it might as well be first anyway. And what an exciting city. That's just absolutely great. It's thrilling, as a matter of fact, particularly if you ride with the... I hope you don't mind me telling you, but this fellow, in addition to being an alcoholic, is a psychiatrist. And he drives like one, too. I tell you, you start the flying around San Francisco, you know what I'm talking about. It scared me to death. But I really had a great time there, and then getting up here and meeting a lot of you guys has just been a great experience. I'm delighted to be here. Going to come back sometime when I got time to stay and visit and do it upright. I've been impressed for a lot of years with the quality of, I don't know if it's the quality of AA that I see here or the spirit of AA that I see in California. Not visiting here, but seeing the people that I've seen who've come out of California and come out to our part of the country. And I've always been impressed, and I've been reminded of it very forcibly here this weekend about the truly dynamic quality, the enthusiasm, the vital kind of action that has gone on. It's been a real good conference. I've enjoyed this thoroughly. And that is a spirit that exists in AA in California that I think is awfully important. There is a quality, too. I listened with much interest today to the workshop on dual addiction. And I was impressed with two things. That there were two words came to mind when that was over. We didn't solve the problem, but we dealt with it in the most reasonable, intelligent manner that I've ever seen anywhere in this country. I thought that was, without a doubt, the most reasonable, intelligent discussion that I'd ever heard on the subject. And I won't add a single thing to it. I thought it was just extremely well done. So I'm pleased to be here. I'm sure that I'm not going to offer a lot to elucidate or illuminate or educate. I'm not even going to try. I'm simply going to share my experience in this program, my own case history, my own life, and what this program's meant in it. That's what I came to do. That's my job. That's what I'm supposed to do. I never do. It's strange how you build up such a vast storehouse of memories over the years in this program. And there's some things that go deep. There's some things that you never forget. I thought about it tonight when Jenny read the announcements. I don't think I've ever been in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous where the chairman came to that point and read the announcement. I didn't remember an experience that I had many years ago. I was in a town, not Southern Pines, and there was a town where there were no women in the group. This was almost 25 years ago. And there weren't any women in that. There were plenty of drunk women in that town, but there weren't any sober ones in that group. And I was the only single guy. I was in my 20s, and I was the only single guy in there, and I was the only one who didn't have a wife to prohibit him from doing 12-step work with women. So I would do it. I learned early on that is extremely hazardous duty. It ain't something that's... I'm not even sure women ought to 12-step women. They are strange. Women drunks are just something. About the second one I went on, I started taking my mother with me. That's God's truth. She's been on more 12-step calls, I'll guarantee you, than 90% of people in this room. I'll guarantee you that. And I was working with this one gal named Shirley. She was 24 years old, and I mean a drunk. If there has ever been a drunk in this world, she was an alcoholic, but drunk's the only term I could think of that just fit her to a T. And Shirley had been sober, oh God, 6 or 8 weeks, just forever it seemed like to me. And I was thrilled to death. You know, that's the longest year I'd ever been sober. And I was chairman of the group that night, and I was going by to pick up Shirley. I got to her house, and there she sat in her living room, just drunker than a billy goat. And I thought, oh, God. Now, if that wasn't bad enough, there was another one sitting there, drunker than Shirley. Well, I didn't have time for a whole lot of deep-seated counseling or anything like that. So I just said, get in the car. You're going to the meeting. I don't care. And so I loaded them up, two drunk women. Now, that ain't real smart, I tell you. I got them up to the meeting. I sat them down. They're sitting right where Dave and May are, sitting on the front row, right where they're supposed to be. Notice even you folks not sitting too far back. Y'all ought to be up here a little closer now next time. They sat them down there. I opened the meeting, and then I came to that point in the program. Any announcements? Well, now, Shirley didn't say anything, but the one I didn't know stuck her hand up. And I said, oh, God, what is it? By then, she'd realized where she was. She said, I'd like to announce that I'd like to get the hell out of here. And she did. I was eating last night. I never saw her again, thank God. Shirley recently celebrated 24 years of continuous sobriety. I guess it really doesn't make a lot of difference about the condition. It's a strange program. That would seem to weigh the odds against making it, wouldn't it? There's a whole lot of things in this program that don't make a whole lot of sense. You know, I'm going to tell a story tonight that defies imagination, and we'll have a little good time with it. We'll probably... It's unreal what we tell each other. And then we'll all sit back and sort of act like we're having a good time, and then we get through, somebody will say, my, that was a wonderful thing there that you did. Wallow around in dirt all night and feel clean as it can be. It don't make sense. Yeah, I'm supposed to be trying to help somebody. I'm going to tell you how bad off I was to help you. Don't make sense, but it works. A lot of things about this program don't make sense. That's the strangest thing in the world. I think Alcoholics Anonymous, without any doubt, is the most remarkable program that I know anything about. And certainly for alcoholics, there's never been anything like it. Think for a minute. Now, I won't make you nervous, but just think for a minute. Who are we? Sitting here tonight now. I'm talking about right in this room. They sent out flyers all over Northern California and said, come on. You just come on. Don't make no difference if you got any money or not. Come on. Well, that's bad enough to start with. Think about who we are. There are people in this room that have got every kind of quality that you can possibly imagine. And the differences are absolutely unbelievable. There are people in here of different races. I've heard people, seen people in here of at least three different races, probably four. There are people in here of different colors. There are even people in here of different languages. Right over in the corner over here, we have Spanish-speaking meetings going on. There are people in here who are enormously wealthy. There are people in here who are broke as a convict. There are people in here of every religion and none. There are even people in here who teach religion, Reverend Platt. In this room, there are people who teach religion. In more ways than one. Different sexes, male, female, some about halfway between. We've got people who came here from jail, others who came here from Yale. This is the only place in the world that I know where pedigree operates in exactly opposite ratio to the way it normally operates in society. The only place in the world I know where you can walk in and present your credentials, and the worse they are, the better you're welcome. It's the darn truth. It's the darn truth. Strangest program in the world. Ain't nobody in charge. Not a soul. James thinks he is. And what did he do? He sits on the front row and listens. He ain't doing nothing. You know, that's the boss. Ain't no rules. No bosses. You get a bunch of aggravated cases like this, thousands strong, and put them in one room. It'll be a minor miracle by normal standards if we don't have a slight riot before tonight's over. That's the fact. In 28 years and a few months in this program, with that kind of composition, I've seen two fights. Now, I'm not talking about arguments. We'll be in arguments before tonight's over. But I'm talking about sure enough good old pool room fights. I've seen two in Alcoholics Anonymous. One of them was, oh, just a guy just didn't like the way he was being sponsored. He went to a meeting, they had intermission, and he went out to the car and had a few drinks of courage and came back and thumped his sponsor right good. That was all right. Everything worked out. The other one, though, it was interesting to me. The other one was over God. I was working with a prison group at our main prison in Raleigh, North Carolina, and I was running a meeting there one night, and we were talking about the third step, and there was great emphasis made about the freedom we have to believe in a power that we're capable of believing in a higher power, and great emphasis put on the fact that you could choose your own conception of God as long as it made sense to you. Well, there was one guy in there that was a fairly straightforward Southern Baptist. And Southern Baptists are not prone to a whole lot of liberalism when it comes to religion. And there was another guy in the group who took it quite literally, and he said his higher power was his chair, because he was sitting in it and held him up, and that was good enough for him. Well, the old Baptist couldn't stand that. He took umbrage to that fellow's higher power. And they got in a fight. I mean, just thrashing around on the floor like a dog right in the middle of a meeting. Get loose, guys, get loose. Well, the only two fights I ever saw.
You know the interesting thing about that, though?
Guess what the punchline was with those two fellas? Strange thing. The very straightforward, fundamentalist thinker died drunk. Not too long after he got out of prison. That weirdo that believed in a chair has been sober ever since he left almost 17 or 18 years ago. He now is the publisher of a newspaper in a city in North Carolina. A weird newspaper. That's a strange kind of thing, though. It really is a remarkable program. It's just absolutely amazing to me that this thing works like it does, but it works beautifully, and beautifully it does work. That's why I'm here tonight, because it works and because it accepts people where they are and works with them at the level of need, and that's why I'm here tonight. I don't know exactly why I'm an alcoholic. I could oversimplify and say it's because I drank too much liquor, and I guess that had something to do with it. I never met an alcoholic in my life who didn't drink. Not a single one. I do think it's connected. But I believe there's more to it than that. I don't believe that just drinking will do it, because I know a lot of people have been drinking all their lives and drinking a lot, and they ain't alcoholic, never will be. Some people got it, and some ain't. For some reason, I was one who was inclined to have troubles with booze. I drank essentially because I liked what it did for me. I drank essentially because I liked the effect. I liked how it made me feel. I liked the sense of adequacy that it gave me. I liked everything about it, and I fell in love with it and had a love affair with it till it almost killed me. I loved everything about booze, but basically it was the effect that I liked. I convinced myself that it was the taste, and I used to lick my lips and smack. But the fact of the business is, I know at least 50 other things that taste better that I couldn't drink two of on a bed. I drank because I liked the effect. I've had two phases in my drinking. I've never had a phase that I could remotely describe as normal or social drinking. I do believe there's such a thing. And I'm not at fault with it. I don't have any fault at all with people who drink. After all, that's where our members come from, is from people who drink. And I know a lot of people who are just nicer folks drinking than they are sober. I'm not here on moral grounds. I'm not here as a WCTU representative. If folks want to drink, I'll just fix them the biggest drink I can and try to rush them up and get them on here. Sooner the better. So on moral grounds ain't mine. I was not one of those. I was not a normal social drinker. I've never in my life, not once, can I remember not taking a drink when I had a chance. I can never remember turning one down. And I can never remember ever agreeing with anybody who told me that I didn't need one. I've been so drunk I couldn't lay on the floor. And somebody say, "Don't you think you've had enough?" And you know what I'd say. Just one more. Just one more. Now, I don't know why that is. I was an excessive problem drinker from the very beginning. I do not believe I was an alcoholic. I was a fellow who drank to excess almost every time. I was not an alcoholic. I was a fellow who had problems with booze from the very start. I was not an alcoholic. I was a fellow who started getting in fights, going to jail, losing jobs, breaking up homes, breaking up cars, getting into terrible messes, passing out, throwing up. I was not an alcoholic. I was a problem drinker. I was an excessive problem drinker from the very beginning. It started with me when my 16th year and into my 18th year, that's what I was. I was an excessive problem drinker, not an alcoholic. In my 18th year, I became an alcoholic. I believe that there is a major difference between alcoholism and any other kind of drinking. We're in a bracket by ourselves. We are not to be confused with other drinkers. I'm not a problem drinker. I'm not a drunk. I'm not an excess drinker. I'm not a dipsomaniac. I'm an alcoholic. I believe that alcoholism's a disease. I don't believe that it's a synonym for sorriness. I don't believe it's a case of moral weakness. I don't believe it's a case of lacking backbone. I don't believe it's a case of just symptomatic behavior. I believe that alcoholism is a disease, a two-part disease, and it came into my life in my 18th year. Now, certainly, I had no realization of that at the time. But there was a tremendous difference in what happened to me in my first phase of problem drinking and what it became when I developed alcoholism. As a problem drinker, I think I might have been shaping some of the compulsive pattern of drinking, some of the obsessive thinking. I do not believe I was a fully developed alcoholic. In my 18th year, that changed, and I did become an alcoholic at that point. I believe that alcoholism is a two-part disease. One part is a mental part. I believe that there is indeed a mental obsession that's part and parcel of alcoholism, characterized by a compulsive need to drink, a compulsion to drink, an obsession to drink that occurs from time to time, regardless of circumstance, regardless of periods of sobriety. A mental obsession to drink. An unmanageable life characterized by strange thinking. Alcoholics don't think like other people, not much. I honestly believe there ought to be a leash law for the brains of alcoholics that we just ain't right. There's something about that. Now, a mental obsession to me is a very complex thing. Let me tell you what a mental obsession is. In my view, like most everything else, I can identify it better by experience. Mental obsession, a strange need to drink. It says in our book that the nature of our disease is such that there are times when the alcoholic is powerless over the urge to take a drink, and nothing short of a higher power will be sufficient. Remember that? I was on an airplane. I'd been sober 3.5 years. I'd never been on an airplane sober since I was a child. I'd never been on a jet plane in my life. And you know how they do when you get on planes these days. They start right up the chimney, and before they even get leveled out, those poor little girls, used to be, they got boys now, but they got poor little girls start pushing those buggies, selling booze. Well, I was sitting there, and I was extremely active in Alcoholics Anonymous then as now. I had been to a meeting the night before. I was in good shape. I was as solidly based in this program as I've ever been. The girl started her buggy up the aisle, and she started to sell booze. Now, I don't know why, but all at once I was overcome with an absolute obsession for a drink. I don't mean the thought that a drink would be nice. I'm talking about an absolute obsession to take a drink. I reached in my pocket. I pulled out a dollar bill. That's what the drink cost back then. I pulled out a dollar bill, and I stuck it up here in my shirt pocket. Now, I don't know about you, but for me, that's problems. I was in deep trouble. I was about like old Victor E. in the grapevine when he paces up and down. What do you do? Well, here I am. By now, I'm probably 20,000 feet in the air. What do? Call your sponsor? Now, even mine can't get there, but go to a meeting, drop by the club. What do? Well, what you do is listen awfully close in meetings when you're not in a crisis, so you know what to do when you are. And what I did, thank God she started at the back of the plane and I was toward the front, because what I did, there's some things I'd heard about in meetings. Number one, I thought back to the last time I drank. God, what a fiasco. What a fiasco. And it was a good exercise. And then I did another thing that I'd heard suggested in meetings. I said a prayer. Wasn't much of a prayer. Only the most profound prayer that man has ever uttered. God, help me. And he did. He did. When the girl came up there, I was so country and so naive, I didn't even know they served coffee on those things. And I asked her if they had any. She said, yeah, and I thought I had to buy it. I didn't know they gave the stuff away. And I ordered a cup of coffee. Now, that's what the book talks about in the need for a higher power, in the need for a... But what I'm talking about is the compulsion. Because here was a healthy, flourishing member of Alcoholics Anonymous, fresh out of a meeting, on the way to another one that night, could not have been in better condition, and all at once, an overpowering obsession, far greater than I could resist, overcame me. I've had that since. I've had that in recent times. It's not something that's dependent on long terms of sobriety. And it's not abnormal for an alcoholic to have that urge to drink. It's quite normal. That's the nature of the disease. That's the nature of the mental obsession. And it's there. But there's another side to this disease. I don't understand it too well either, but there's a side that's physical. Now, I believe exactly like it says in our book, and it's good enough for me, that there is a physical side that's an allergy to alcohol. I have a peculiar reaction to alcohol. And that happened with me in my 18th year. That's where I truly became an alcoholic. Now, I've read, like many of you have, I've read many, many things about alcoholism. I've read books about alcoholism. I've read all kinds of complicated things about heredity and enzyme factors and the Rx factors and all kind of stuff. And I'm sure there's great validity in all of that. After reading hundreds, the most simple, workable, practical explanation of alcoholism that I've ever seen is in the third paragraph, first sentence, of chapter 3 of our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, where it says these words: "We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking." That's it. That's it. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. And that's exactly what happened to me. Up to that point, even though I was an excessive, episodic, dumb drinker, I could have stopped drinking had I wanted to. From that point on, even though I did not know it at the time, I could not have stopped drinking from that point on. My life from that point was to never be the same until this night, and it never will be again. What happened to me that night was that I reached a point where I developed that physical allergy, and I started to experience a thing called craving. Craving. People who are not alcoholics do not experience craving and never will. It's peculiar to alcoholics. And I don't understand craving either, except I know what it feels like. It's the thing that dooms me to get drunk if I take one drink of anything. And I learned that by my bitter experience. And I learned it since by watching hundreds of my fellows in this program try it. And I've seen people, unfortunately, with more than 30 years in this program try it. And I've never seen one yet for whom it didn't end in disaster. A physical side, a physical allergy, and I've tried everything from VO to Vitalis hair tonic. And every bit of it did exactly the same thing. I was an alcoholic. Now, I didn't see any difference in that probably the week before and the week after. To any observer, including me, there was no discernible difference. I drank about the same amount, the same results. The difference was that craving had started to occur, and I had lost the choice in the matter of how much I drank. I didn't know it, because we have another little system that goes on called denial. That's an extremely powerful thing that exists in the mind of an alcoholic. I never believed I was an alcoholic, no matter what happened, until well after I was in this program. And from that point on, the story was a fairly typical one. 1,000 bizarre, unbelievable, shameful, embarrassing, disgusting, dirty things that was my life. All I have to do to appreciate the impact of my story is to take a look at just the extremes of it. Take a look at that 16-year-old kid who bounced out of Belmont High School. Somebody mentioned being from Belmont. For mine was another Belmont. Bouncing out of Belmont High School, 16 years old, full of optimism and hope like any 16-year-old kid. and contrast him to the fellow who 8 short years later had reached a point of complete hopelessness and helplessness, the point that I lived on the streets in a large city up north, Flint, Michigan. I lived there as a street character in 8 short years. And in between, I don't know of any single thing that a man can do that I haven't done. Now, you can be sure that I'm not proud of that by any means, but that's simply the way it is. Not a single thing that a man can commit that I haven't committed. You know, it's a strange thing about alcoholism and what it's about, the nature of the disease, the nature of the story, the nature of what it used to be like, what it used to be like. What is it that motivates us to hang on? What is it you suppose that motivates me after more than 28 years to pray God that it'll be at least that much longer? What do you suppose? Suppose it's the fear of going to jail again. I used to go to jail every town I went in. I don't even know. I bet I couldn't guess within 20 the times that I've been in jail. I doubt very seriously, though, that it's the fear of going to jail again. It's getting very difficult to get in jail. You, a drunk ain't got a chance. I tell you, you got to have connections to get in jail now. Fear of losing my job, I'm almost eligible for retirement. Fear of losing my wife, my wife's never seen me take a drink. I was sober 11 years when we were married, and she knows I'm an alcoholic. She knows I'm a little weird. But my active alcoholism is about like watching As the World Turns or the Days of Our Lives or something like that. It's a story. I don't know what she'd do. She doesn't either. The fear of getting my nose broke again, the fear of getting hit with a blackjack, the fear of getting rolled and all of that, I rather doubt that. You know, I don't know how you measure your alcoholism, but it's not the external events that are the nature of the condition that I never want to know again. Let me tell you what I'm talking about in very, very simply. I really believe when I look at the nature of this and what it is I don't want to know again, the thing I like to remember is the thing that nobody else knew, is what it was like on the inside. What is it that binds all of us together? You know, the stories are obviously different in this room. What is it that binds us together? It's not the activities or the experiences that we had. It was that point of the suffering that occurred on the inside. The thing that makes it, strangely enough, I was in this program for about 2 years before I ever heard another member with whom I identified. And now I never hear one that I don't identify with. Strange thing, isn't it? What is it that binds us together? What is the nature of this disease? What is it that motivates us? What is it that makes me want to hang on? Example, what I like to remember what it was like to be 21 years old. Time in life when most people are cocky and full of themselves and sure they're going to be world beaters just getting started in life. And the most prevalent thought in my mind at 21 was the feeling of total, utter despair. Even by then, had reached such a point of hopelessness and futility, I look at myself in the mirror and want to throw up at what I saw. And the most constant thought was, I just wished it were done. 21. I pray to my God that I'll never forget that feeling of complete despair and that I'll never know it again. I like to remember the fear. I'm not talking about fright of something. I'm not talking about that kind of fear. But there's a kind of fear that exists in the lives of alcoholics almost to a person. That has nothing to do with fear of something. It's the fear that's the way we live. I believe that it's a product of the total lack of faith. Where faith doesn't live, fear flourishes. How many times have you heard fear talked about in the halls of AA, that cold knot in the stomach that's always there? I like to remember the fear that was my life. that permeated every waking moment of my life, the kind of fear that used to wake me at 4 o'clock in the morning, invariably, and cause me to jump straight up. For no reason, it's just the way I was. The kind of fear that gave me the constant sense of dread, the fear of opening the door, the fear of answering the phone, the fear that was my companion everywhere that I went. The fear that ran the gamut from mild anxiety all the way to total panic. Fear that was so real, I could taste it. I couldn't define it, but I couldn't deny it because it was always there. I pray to my God that I'll never know that fear again, and I needn't know it again. I like to remember the loneliness. National Council, a few years back, put out a poster, and it had a caption under a guy on a park bench. And the caption said, "The Lonely Disease." I don't think I've ever heard a truer description of this disease than that one, the Lonely Disease. That's a thing that you can easily misunderstand because it isn't really it's not a kind of loneliness that really relates to other loneliness. There's a difference in it. And we can get hung up on that right easy, I think. See, everybody in the world knows loneliness. I'll guarantee you that sitting in this room tonight, there are people here who feel as absolutely alone and lonely as anybody on the face of this earth. Sitting in this room. Some of them because of their alcoholism, others for other reasons. See, everybody knows loneliness. For most people, loneliness is a product of aborted relationships. It has to do with the absence of someone that you want to be around, somebody you want to share your life with. If you want to take a look at loneliness, talk to somebody who's recently widowed. Talk to somebody who is recently divorced in their middle age. Talk to somebody who has lost their job that they've invested a lifetime in. Talk to somebody that's lost their mother. Talk to somebody in a nursing home if you want to know what loneliness is about. See, everybody knows loneliness, but for most people, it has to do with the absence of those they love. And that's not the way it is with alcoholics, is it? Because our loneliness doesn't have to do with the proximity of people, at least not physically. It has to do with our inability to relate to those people. And what I believe that our loneliness is a product of our self-centered condition. There's a guy down our way, Keith, that talks about the experience of coming home half drunk and going to bed with his wife and both of them lying in the bed, stiff as a board, pretending to be asleep because they no longer know what to say to each other. Now, that's what loneliness is about. That's the loneliness of alcoholism. It has nothing to do with people. It has to do with the ability to relate. And what we did, what I did anyway, was drink myself, drink by drink, bottle by bottle, into a glass prison that was so thick that nobody could get in and I couldn't get out. And I finally lived in complete isolation. I had no relationships with anybody. The only kind of emotions that I could nurture were the negative ones of hate or resentment. I could not sustain a warm, loving relationship with anybody. Loneliness. And I pray to my God that I'll never know that loneliness again. And I don't have to. Much, much more. That, to me, those are the things that really spell out this condition. That's what happened to me that's important. This thing of knowing that my life was falling apart and being unable to admit it to myself. Living in that constant false hope that this time it'll be different. A new town, a new place, a new friend, a new wife. This time it'll be different. It was always the same. I was a weird drunk. I was somebody who was, I think I was prone to disaster. There was no doubt in my mind. I was the kind of guy that was going to come to no good end. I knew that. I used to rather morbidly predict my own death that I didn't think I'd get to be 30. I don't have any doubt that would have been true. I was the kind of guy that, as you gathered, had to be brought to a stop Unfortunately, I wasn't brought to a stop quite enough, because I wound up drinking long enough that I wound up doing great damage, greater damage than most alcoholics ever do, thank God. I don't think I've ever known an alcoholic, and particularly those who have lived with blackouts, who haven't operated with the rather pervasive fear that somehow or other in a drunken mess, they might wind up doing irrevocable damage to somebody else. Thank God most don't. But I'm here to tell you that some do. I woke up one morning in the Genesee County Jail in Flint, Michigan, a jail I'd been in many, many times. And after I was awake for a while, the jailer came by and asked him when I could get out. And he said, "I hope never," and walked off. I had no earthly idea what the man was talking about, but I knew he wasn't kidding. And a little later on, some of the other fellows in the bullpen told me that the night before, driving somebody's car down the main street of that city, that I had run down and killed two people, two young folks. I'm not a subhuman. I'm not somebody who is callous about human life. I guess my reaction was fairly predictable. It was fairly understandable. I simply couldn't deal with it. I just simply could not believe, could not live with the fact that I had done something like that. It was a matter of, you know, how do you balance the scales between a street drunk and two fine young people with their lives in front of them? Well, obviously you don't. My reaction was just to sink into the corner. I was so full of grief and sorrow and shame that I just could not face anybody. That's the only time I'd ever been in jail. I didn't try to get out. I didn't tell a soul I was in there. After a couple of weeks, somebody contacted my mother down in North Carolina. That dear lady made what I hope and pray was her last trip to anybody's jail to get her little boy out. It wasn't her first one, but I hope and pray it was her last one. She made arrangements for a bond, and I was held in there for 76 days before I was released to await trial. Now, I'd done a lot of thinking, of course. I knew that I would never take another drink as long as I lived. I knew that. It wasn't somebody I told somebody. It was just a knowledge. I knew. I didn't believe I could ever pick up a drink. And I stayed sober a day and a half. And then for the next few months, I drank like nobody I have ever seen in my life. And I don't mean that in any braggadocio way that I was the world's worst two-fisted drinker. That's not what I'm talking about. I completely gave in to my condition. And I was a guy whose constant search was for oblivion. I was deliberately, intentionally trying to drink myself to death, and obviously I didn't do that. November the 19th, 1956, I had what I hope and pray was my last drink. Certainly had no thoughts of that at the time. I didn't have too many thoughts of anything at the time. But that morning I finished off what I had, which was a little piece of a bottle of gin, about that much. And I went to trial. There was no trial. I couldn't even tell anybody what I did. My plea was to stand mute. And I think it was probably the most eloquent thing I could have done, because I just didn't know. And I stood in front of a man that day, a man by the name of Steve Roth, fine man, very fine man. He later went on the federal bench and retired. He's dead now. Fine man. And he talked with me. And then he passed sentence. Now I knew that I was not coming out of there. I've thought a lot of times that I think probably the cruelest sentence that could have been given to me would have been if Judge Roth had just said, "Just go on. Just go on and live with yourself." I think it would have been the cruelest sentence that could have been given, but that wasn't it. He sentenced me to 5 to 15 years, state prison, Southern Michigan. I knew what that meant. When you're a street character, you know that jail is an occupational hazard. But there's a difference between jails and penitentiaries. And I knew that. I'd never been in a penitentiary. And Jackson Prison, I knew, was not Sunnybrook Farm. I knew that. And the next day, November 20th, 1956, I was loaded, literally loaded on a log chain, it looked like, with five other guys, and walked off to Jackson. And when I walked into that place, I never believed I would ever come out of there alive. I never believed I would. And I, honest to God, didn't care. Truly didn't care. Just a piece of human garbage being filed away
And I knew that I was gone and probably was relieved of anything. I felt totally devoid of hope. I didn't really know how sick I was till I started to get well. And I was a mighty sick young man. I never spoke to people. I never carried on any conversation. I sat in my cell. I never did anything but read, just anything I could do to keep from thinking. Never engaged in a conversation with a single person. Unless somebody came and got me out of the cell and took me away. And one day I was carried out by a young fellow, a social worker there at that prison, a young man named Martin. I'll never forget him. He didn't work there very long, but thank God he worked there long enough for me to meet him. But he called me out and he did an interview with me. And it was a fairly standard textbook social worker interview. And I'm sure I did a fairly standard textbook alcoholic response. Lied like a dog, I'm sure. That's all I'd ever done. Strange, though, his diagnosis was exactly the same as every diagnosis I'd ever had. I never been diagnosed by anybody as anything but, my God, you sure drink a lot, or something like that. Well, this guy got through with his interview. He drew that conclusion. You sure look like you had a lot of trouble with booze. Then he added something I'd never heard before. He said, we have an AA group here, and I think you better go. That was exactly the way he put it. It wasn't an invitation. It wasn't an order. It was just a flat declarative statement. We have a group, think you better go. And I don't know if we had any more conversation up, but when I walked out, I had never heard of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. Now, this wasn't the Ice Age, you know, in 1956 and 7. It's not ancient history. But I had never heard the words Alcoholics Anonymous in my life. I didn't even know people helped drunks. That was sort of a foreign concept to me. What do you do? You don't help drunks. You shoot them and lock them up. And yeah, I could imagine helping a drunk. I wasn't thrilled about going to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm sure that all of you were just absolutely delighted when you found out you were going to get to join up. I don't believe I've ever seen anybody that was overjoyed about joining Alcoholics Anonymous. Somehow they had an image problem with me. I thought it was going to be a sad thing. I could just picture this bunch of worn-out old dudes sitting in there telling war stories, commiserating to each other. It just seemed sad to me. I just pictured them sort of dim room about like this one. And I wasn't thrilled about going. Yeah, I never had wanted to be sober. I never wanted to be sober in my life. And I honestly believed that sober was just about the most miserable condition that a man could suffer. I really did. I didn't want to be drunk either. You know, I wanted to be about halfway between there. You know, there's a little place, a little plateau that we used to achieve for an elusive few moments every once in a while. That's nirvana for the alcoholic, you know, where you can just sort of sink into a nice, comfortable stool and sip on a tall, cool thing and close your eyes and drift off and be anything in the world you want to be. A great, great place. Now, that's where I wanted to be, and if I could have found a way to be there, that's where I'd be tonight, I'll guarantee you. I wouldn't be here. No way, but I had a tendency to fall off the stool and puke on the carpet a lot. So I didn't do well in that environment. Now that was sort of in the back of my mind, I think. I did not really want to be sober. I thought, you know, I just wanted to sit and stare at my navel. I didn't want to get in there with a bunch of folks talking about stuff like that. So I went through about going. I sat into my first meeting. Now, I don't know what your first meeting is. Some of you, this is your first meeting. And no matter what you think of this one tonight, I'll guarantee you it won't compare with what I thought of mine any worse anyway. But I sat down and I listened, and they did about the same thing we did here tonight. Read the stuff, about the same stuff. They read the minutes of the meeting. I'd never ever seen another group did that. Then they introduced the speaker. And the fellow who spoke that day was a guy by the name of Shy Walker from Kalamazoo, Michigan. He was one of the finest guys I ever met in my life. That day, when I listened to him stand in front of that group and tell his story, I thought he had to be the biggest fool I'd ever met. I could not imagine anybody getting in front of a bunch of strangers and telling something like that. It just made no sense to me at all. And I didn't identify with him. He was as unlike me as anybody I've ever met in my life. He was a little short fella, He was about 5'5", 5'6". And he looked all right from a distance. You know, he was quite a bad-looking guy. Dressed up in a blue suit, but he didn't stand close examination too well, because that fellow apparently had been beat up with everything in the world. He'd been a professional fighter at one time, and apparently not a very good one, because he really was a sluggy, heavy. But that little guy, you know, I listened to that man tell his story, and I did not relate to anything. I'd never heard anything like that in my life. But for some reason, I went back the next week, and I thought about it a lot of times. Why? What was it that made the difference? What was it that caused me to go? I didn't have to. Yeah, I don't know where else I'd have gone, but I didn't have to go there. But I went back. I never missed a meeting the entire time I stayed in that place, 42 months. I believe that it was the thing I talked about, the quality in this California AA, a simple thing called enthusiasm. I really believe that's what it was. Yeah, I led a meeting in a treatment center just a while back, and my topic was, is there life after sobriety? And that was the kind of questions that I had, you know, because here I was, a 24-year-old youngster, and I was thinking, my God, you know, I drink 8 hours a day, at least 8 hours a day. I put in about an average 8 hours drinking each day. I had never done anything in my life. I'd never even been intimate with a lady sober since I was a kid, you know, it's kind of an awkward feeling when where do you get girls if you ain't drinking? I didn't know folks I didn't know folks in churches did stuff like that. You know, I really didn't. I don't know where all babies came from. But anyway, how do you pick up women? Anyway, stuff like that. Is there life after sobriety? And I think what really influenced me the most was this fellow talking about his life. He didn't need to tell you that he was happy. It just absolutely jumped out and grabbed you. He was one of those people that you just loved, you cherished time around. Because he carried himself that way, in a way that just sort of reached out and grabbed you. And I think that's the reason I went back to the next meeting. For the next 8 months, I think I was probably as miserable as I've ever been in my life. I was sitting in meetings. I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I said I was. I hated to be the only one in there that wasn't, you know, so I'd say I was, but it didn't mean a thing. It was just words. But you know, I'm a great believer in this notion of act as if. Act as if. If I had waited in this program to do the things that I have done until I felt ready to do them, as of today, I would have done a net nothing. That's the God's truth. Including this tonight, I would have done a net nothing. Everything I've ever done, I've done before I felt ready. And I tell you the darn truth, this program's carried me so far. I operate over my head so much, I get air sick. I really do. Act as if. And I'm a great believer now. I don't care if it's phony as a $3 bill. I believe in it. I said I was an alcoholic before I believed I was. And I finally came to know it. It's the most fundamental fact of my life. I said I believed in God before I did. I acted as if I did, and sure enough, the faith, mine was weirder than the guy with the chair. But it grew. It grew. Act as if. For those 8 months, I went through the motions, essentially. I read the stuff. I listened to speakers. I listened to discussions. I didn't participate, but I was there. And I acted as if. I had a tenuous hold on this thing. It was just words and fleeting ideas. Very tenuous hold. I would have been knocked over by the first feather that hit me. And you know, it's a strange thing. Now, what made the difference? Out of 300 people in that group, there is one who has been sober since his first meeting. One. There's another one of my best friends over in Detroit, that's had some problems, and he's been sober now for a good many years. And I can't help but wonder, and obviously I was the one. Well, I don't know how obvious it is, but I was the one. And I tell you right now, if they'd have put it to a vote tonight, I'd vote for exactly that outcome. Now, I'm a fairly hard-nosed fellow about this program. I'm not like a dear friend that I have. I heard him say in a meeting down in North Carolina one night, sort of rhetorically speaking, but he said, if one of us, you know, me or you, the group, if one of us has to drink, I hope it's me instead of you. Ain't that nice? Ain't that loving? Now, you can feel that way if you want to. But fellow alcoholics, I love you madly. But if one of us has to drink, I hope I'm the last dude in this room that does it. Now, that may be a little hard. No, that's the way it is now. That's just the way it is. Because what was it made different? I'm the one guy out of that group that survived. And I honestly believe, without any exaggeration, I was probably the worst candidate in the crowd. I really do. I didn't believe I was an alcoholic. I was 10 years younger than anybody in the group. Back then, there were no young people in AA. I didn't know about this program. I was resistant. I didn't particularly want to be there. I felt like I was totally unworthy of help. I really believe I was about as bad a candidate as was in that group. Now, what happened? I'd gone through those motions. I had the tenuous hold. I had the words and the ideas. What happened? Well, I think it comes down to this. There are two things that I believe about this program that are pretty fundamental. Now, I believe that this is a program of the head. I believe that this program demands the very best that I have and then some. I believe that this program demands that I participate, that I read, that I belong to a home group, that I actively carry out this program to the very best of my ability. I believe that it requires some discipline. I believe it requires some integrity. I believe it requires that I take stands on things. I believe that it requires that I do what's right to the very best of my ability. I am not a member of the feel-good generation. I do not believe that if it feels good, it's okay. I simply don't believe that. I believe that I have to be willing to part with my friends if my friends aren't willing to respect who I am and what I'm about. It demands the very best that I have, and then some. So it is a program of the head. But I think in a very real sense, when you get down to what this program's truly about, I think it's exactly about what Reverend Flack prayed about. It's about that single person that had meaning in my life. That person that made this thing come alive and made me possible to see in somebody else's image. What made the difference? What was it? And I don't know about the other 299, but I know what made the difference with me. And when I think back to what made the difference, what was it? It gave me some hope and the fervent desire for a new way of life. I think of people, because fellow alcoholics, I think this is a program of the heart. It's a program of the heart. It's a program about one drunk helping another. And the minute that this program gets 1 inch taller than that, 1 ounce bigger than that, it's done got too big. That's the most magnificent thing that we'll ever do. It ain't about conferences in Santa Rosa. This is celebration. This is good times. This is the social event. This is the celebration of that. Don't ever let it get bigger than one drunk helping another. That's what it's about. And I say that because I think that's truly what made the difference to me. When I think back to what made the difference, I remember people. I remember Shy, that little pug ugly ex-fighter. Crude man. He was in this program almost 20 years when he died. When he died, he was on the steps of the State Mental Hospital, Ypsilanti, Michigan, on the way in to conduct a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And knowing Shy, if he'd have changed anything about that, he would have preferred dying on the way out after the meeting. Great little guy, got a third grade education. In all the time he was in AA, he never learned to pronounce Alcoholics Anonymous. He never learned to pronounce it. He lived it better than anybody ever saw. But he never learned the words. He was just like grape egg. And what that man gave me was the sure knowledge that just maybe there was some life here. Even though I didn't recognize it, I remember the feeling that came. And he became my first sponsor. I loved him better than Peter loved the Lord. I remember a fellow by the name of Glenn Coffey. Glenn Coffey was from Battle Creek, Michigan. He's been dead for a number of years. And Glenn Coffey was a man who loved this program so intensely that when he spoke to a group of Alcoholics Anonymous, he literally attacked the group. He would put Billy Sunday to shame because he felt so powerfully about what had happened. And when you sat and listened to him, you knew what being galvanized was about. That man was absolutely a dynamo. I remember that fellow. I remember a fellow by the name of Johnny Snow. Johnny Snow was an Indian fellow from Lansing, Michigan. A man who washed dishes in a restaurant for a living. He was totally illiterate. I doubt that he could read and write his own name. We invited him to come to that prison one day. And Johnny, found out later, left at 4 o'clock in the morning. It was only a 60-mile trip, but he left at 6 o'clock in the morning because he didn't want to be late, and you see, he had to hitchhike. Now, I'm not sure what Johnny Snow's speech was about that day, because Johnny Snow didn't make a speech that day. What he did was carry the most profound message that any alcoholic could ever carry. That much loving and caring and sharing. I remember Johnny Snow. I remember a big old Dutchman still living. His name's Pete Slager. I'll break his anonymity whether he likes it or not. He's one of my dearest friends. I had a letter from Pete 2 weeks ago from the intensive care unit at Hackley Hospital in Muskegon, Michigan. He wrote me, told me about his heart attack, and then inquired about how I was doing. Pete Slager's a great big Dutchman, about 6'4", 6'5". Ugly man. One of the most bitter people I've ever seen in my life. When he tells his story, the bitterness is there. Pete had his right eye, kicked out by a prison guard when he was 15. And he'd never really gotten over that. But Pete Slager got into Alcoholics Anonymous. Hear me. For 34 years, Pete Slager has gone to Jackson Prison on a regular basis because guys like me were there, and he still does it. Sometimes I dare to use the word dedication. Fellow alcoholics, I don't even know what it means. Don't even know what it means. Many, many more. When I think about why I'm here, that's what I remember, because people cared about me and they cared enough to show it. And that's what this program's about. This program is about love and service. This program's not about distilled philosophy. It's not about one-line put-downs. It's not about shock. That's not what it's about. This program's about love and service. It's about understanding in a peculiar kind of way and loving enough to show it. Sometimes I get a little bit concerned. I guess one of the things that happens after you've got a few years in the program, for some reason, I don't know what it is about the stages of man, but there are things that happen at certain intervals. When you're 40 years old, you all of a sudden fear falling. I don't know why. When you're 39 years old, you don't mind. You just bounce and get up. When you're 40, you're scared to death. When you're 25 years sober in this program, you all at once start to view an alarm. And you never view an alarm until you get 25 years, I don't think. Well, that's what happened to me. And I do view an alarm sometimes. I'm not one who believes, that's why I appreciated that discussion so much about dual addiction this afternoon. I am not one who believes that we're just automatically getting better in this program. I'm not one who believes that everything is just fine and dandy and we can just keep on taking bows and have at it. I see some trends in this program that are bothersome to me. One is a thing that I call me and my program. Now, I'm not sure exactly where it comes from. I don't mean to make a whipping boy out of treatment centers, but I believe that's where it comes from. And even though I've never been one to a treatment center, I am deeply grateful for the fact that they exist, where alcoholics are treated like human beings and not locked up and cast out like I was. I'm deeply thankful that they're there. But there are some byproducts, and I think that's one of them, this me and my program. I believe it comes out of a highly individualized attention that's given. And it's given out of the notion that this program is sort of a do-it-yourself kit that you do on your own. And I honestly believe that it's dangerous. I honestly believe that it plays right into the alcoholic syndrome that got us here to start with. I believe it plays right into the self-centeredness that's so fundamentally a part of this disease. This ain't no me program, fellow alcoholics. This is a we program. A we program. The day it quits being, we're in trouble. The day that Alcoholics Anonymous becomes just another agency, we will start to lose our value. Now, I believe that. I believe that. Anyway, that's the thing that happened to me. And when I look back to what made the difference, that's the thing that I remember. Those people who truly entered into my life in the special way that only a drunk can. I'll be ever grateful for those men and many, many more, because that's the thing that gave me the hope. But emotion's not really enough, though, is it? It's not enough to be inspired or to be absolutely lifted up by somebody. That's not enough, because it is a program of the head. And I think the thing that really turned the corner for me, I don't ever really like to tell my story without going into this a bit. The thing that started to give me at least the introduction to what I like to think of as mature sobriety, again, came from somebody else. A fellow came to the group one night and he spoke for a solid hour about nothing but the fourth step. And he went into great detail about where to find it in the book, about the critical importance of writing it down, all of that. And when he got through, I went back to my cell and I said, okay, I'll try that. Now, what I meant to do was to write a little dissertation about life's cruelties and how a nice fellow like me got in such a mess is about what I meant to write. The founders were wise when they said to write it, because you can rationalize and scheme and excuse anything in the world if you just keep it in the privacy of your own mind. It is very difficult to lie to yourself in black and white. And I went back to the cell and started to write. I wrote about two lines of what I had in mind then without any intention whatsoever. I started to write about me. And I've heard a lot of people say that taking the fourth step's difficult. Maybe it is. I could not have refused to take a fourth step that night if I'd wanted to. The dam broke. And then it was just a torrent. My hand literally flew trying to keep up with the racing thoughts. What it was a young man taking the first look he'd ever taken in his life, ever. The finest day's work I've ever done, because when I got through, I knew that I was an alcoholic, period. Not the youngster, not the tragic case, not the intellectual, not the atheist. I was an alcoholic, period. And I knew I wanted to do something about it. I never wanted to be a bum. I was. I never wanted to eat in greasy spoon restaurants. I never wanted to always reach out for the inferior. I never wanted to be the butt of jokes. I never wanted to be the object of ridicule. I wanted to be a decent human being. I always had, but I didn't know how. I did not know that I couldn't take one drink. I knew that. I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous. Different than I'd been, I went back with some desperate need for this program. I was not an easy case like most of us. I fought everything in this program. Nothing fit. Thank God I lost every fight. And therein lies the true paradox of this program. We do indeed surrender to win. We die to live. We give it away to keep it. I heard it said one time that what God would use, He first reduces to nothing. And how true that was of me. It was only when I got to the point that my will was completely beaten down and I was open to new ideas that change started to occur. And they did start to occur. I started to have this program work for me right there. First day of freedom I ever knew in my life, strangely enough, was a Jackson prison, locked up in a cage like a gorilla at a zoo. Behind a wall 40 feet high, couldn't see sunshine but a few hours a day. Strangely enough, that's the first freedom I ever knew, was right there. And I learned what we all do. Freedom's not something somebody gives you. It's not something they take away. It's a gift, all right, but it's a gift of God. And it has a lot to do with freedom and with discipline, with responsibility. I finally got out. No trouble getting out of jail. This takes time. And I immediately got active. They insisted that I go back to North Carolina. They wouldn't let me stay in Michigan. And I immediately got active. I made a meeting the first night and most nights thereafter for a long time. And I want to share with you very quickly just some things that happened in my life, some veritable miracles that happened in my life. And I offer this just in case there's anybody here that might be wavering some in the Hope Department. What happens when you give your life to this simple program? Well, I don't know what's going to happen to yours, but let me tell you what happened to mine. When I left Jackson Prison, the only job that I could get, and I had to have a job to get out, was sweeping the floor in a cotton mill on the third shift in Gastonia, North Carolina. And I'll guarantee you I could not have been more grateful if they had elected me governor of the state. I was truly grateful for that job, and I am to this day for that job. It sure beat cutting hair for 10 cents a day at Jackson Prison. And I was deeply grateful. I was a pretty darn good sweeper, too. I was real good. About 2 weeks after I was out, I started working in a little small prison near my home. And 2 months after I was out, I was asked to be the outside sponsor. Can you imagine that? Just 2 months earlier, I had been in one of those places, and they asked me to have a trusted role as the outside sponsor for the A group. And it meant a great deal to me. About the same time, my parole officer came to me one day, and he asked me, he said, "Tom, you're pretty active in this AA thing, aren't you?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I am." And it kind of scared me a bit. I thought he was going to tell me to slow down. And he said, "Wouldn't it help you if you could drive?" And I said, "Yes, sir, but I can't." On my parole papers when I left, in letters easily half-inch tall, said, "This man's never drink alcoholic beverages. This man's never drive a motor vehicle." And I was just fatalistic enough to know that that meant exactly what it said. I'd never given any thought to it. He said, "Okay, let me do some checking." About 2 weeks later, he called me, asked me if I could meet him up at the Sears store. I walked into the Sears store, and he was standing there with the fellow that ran the license agency. I walked in, and he handed me a driver's license. I didn't take a test. I didn't drive. He didn't even ask me if I could drive. I didn't even pay for it. Didn't pay a thing. Now, folks, you can call that anything in the world you want to. Don't call it political connections. Don't do that. But short of that, you can call it anything you want to. I call it a pure miracle. And I'll tell you something. I honest to God believe if I had been trying to manipulate and con that man into doing that, I'd be walking today. I really believe that. Well, God's laws don't just succumb to ours very much, do they? 5 months after I was out, the groups in our area, Wally, were getting ready to have election for DCM. I barely knew what a DCM was. I wasn't even running. And they elected me for the job. Now, not everybody gets thrilled about being elected DCM. I did. Because I was the same guy who just a short time before had sat in Jackson Prison and wondered if I would ever have one friend. One friend. I wondered if there was any human being in the world who would ever trust me to do anything. And here were the AA members in 12 cities asking me to be their trusted servant. And it meant a great deal to me. About 2 years after I was out, I was sitting in my house one day and I got a telephone call from our state capitol. The man on the other end asked for Mr. Ivester, and I knew something then, and so I got on the phone and he introduced himself. He said, "Mr. Ivester, we're thinking about expanding the rehabilitation program in our prison system, And we were wondering if you might consider taking a position. I've never been offered a job in my life by anybody, unless some drunk on a bar stool who didn't have one himself. Here's a man talking about a position beyond anything I could imagine. And I quickly asked, I said, you sure you know who you're talking to? And he said, yeah, we probably know you better than you know yourself. And he did. I knew it wouldn't happen, but it did. November 1961, I was employed as a supervisor in the rehabilitation program in North Carolina. And for the next 9 years, I had the great privilege of working full-time with guys very much like me. I worked primarily with guys with booze, drug problems, did a lot of staff training, stuff like that. Then after 9 years, some people started coming to me. You know, it's an interesting thing. The slogan says, AA first, the rest will follow. Interesting thing to me. From the day I walked into this program to this day, I have never applied for one single job. Not one single job. Or promotion or anything else. And I've been working the system 9 years. Hadn't had a vacation, and I didn't need one. And some folks started coming to me and asked me if I would consider taking over a prison. I wonder if I'd consider being a warden. That was about my reaction. I never had considered being a warden. I never considered being a convict either. I really did want to do it. I felt somehow like I didn't want to be the man, you know. And finally, I saw that it might be a real opportunity to be of service. And I finally agreed in 1970 in my state. I became the head of a prison. And if you don't think that's a long way from Jackson Prison, and that's what I've been doing for the last 15 years is running prisons. And it's what I do today. And it's a I guess it's some of the old insecurity or something, but I know sometimes I'll be sitting in a conference and in the back of my mind I'll have a thought of, you suppose these folks really know? I'm looking for somebody to speak up and say, see me over there and say, what the hell are you doing here? But no, it's very real. And a lot of times I get frustrated with it. It's a difficult job, of course. I don't know of a tougher job. I don't know of one that I'd trade for in the entire world. Sometimes when I get feeling beleaguered and beaten down and I get opportunities to make lots of money and stuff like that, all I have to do is take a look around and realize that I've got several hundred young people in those institutions just about the ages of the ones I killed many, many years ago. And I know that God's in His place and I'm where He wants me to be. So I don't argue with it. I don't question it. I plan to finish out my career and do the very best I can to be the kind of prison administrator that this program makes it possible for me to be. That's what I do for a living. And what I really important, I live in that little town, Aberdeen. It literally is. If you don't believe that's Dave May, it literally is about two-thirds the size of this group. We've got one traffic light. Five cars show up at the same time. We've got a terrible traffic jam. But that's my town. I'm a citizen of that town. And even though it's small, it's sure a lot bigger than that 9x7 cell. I'm a citizen there. I pay taxes. I vote. I'm on the school council of my county. I'm a citizen there. I live there. I'm part of that community. A while back, they had an annexation of my community. I never explained it to anybody, but I was the only guy in the neighborhood that wouldn't sign a petition to not be annexed. I think you can probably understand why I didn't. I was on the outside long enough. I like being in. I like being a part of things. So I'm a citizen. I'm a married man. I'm a husband. And I got married because I've been married three times in my life, legally. I married once to a lady and I was drunk. I didn't even know her. I didn't know who the woman was. She obviously didn't know who I was. And I was married one time shortly after I came. I say shortly. I'd been in 85 years and I was married, and that one lasted a couple of years. And then I was married this time. I had healed a little. And I got married because I wanted to be the husband to that woman. Not just somebody that had a wife, but I wanted to be a husband. And it's a good feeling to somebody who at one time didn't know how to love. So today I'm a husband. I'm a father. I have two of the finest kids in the face of this earth. And they really are fine little guys. Daughter will be 14 in July, and son 16 in October. And I'm the father to those kids. And I love them very dearly. I'm an employee, and I'm an excellent worker. I'm an excellent worker. And I'm an employer. I have about 250 or 300 people that work under my supervision. And I wish I could hire that many who work just as good as me. Really do. And that ain't ego, that's just the way it is. That's the way this program works, because my belief is this, fellow alcoholics. This program not only does not compete with other things in the world, it does not conflict with anything in my life. Nothing. If this program does not make me a better husband, a better father to my children, a better citizen, a better employee, a better employer, I better check up and see what happened, because I think I just missed the boat. And let me close in a strange way. I'm grateful for this program. But what it does is gives us an opportunity to live. It doesn't shield us from life, but it gives us the opportunity to live life. And our lives are not going to be different than other people. Our lives are going to be life. And there's going to be bad, and there's going to be good, and there's going to be joy, and there's going to be pain. But the thing that I'm grateful for is because it does give us the opportunity to live and to be a responsible part of this thing called life. My mother had a serious stroke a little over a year ago. And strokes, I've learned, happen two different ways, really. One has rapid recovery and the other one has very slow, and hers is the latter. And one reason I know about nursing homes is because she's had to be confined in one because she can't be cared for at home. Now, there's nothing about a stroke of somebody you love that's going to give you any feeling of gratitude, is there? No, there's not. There's nothing joyful about that. That's a very difficult, painful kind of tragic condition. And there's no joy about that. But I'll tell you what there is joy about. And my mother, looking at her going through this problem and realizing that this program makes it possible for me to be the strength of the family, making it possible for me to be a sensitive, loving, caring, seems that lady being able to add something to her life and to care is what this program's about. It doesn't shield us from life, but thank God, it puts us in tune with it and helps us live it and live it beautifully. Thanks very much. Thank you.